Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Roger, a student at King's College London.
And this is That Medic Podcast.
In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Abdullah Albiyati, the CEO and co-founder of MyClinic, an international telemedicine supplier, enabling doctors to connect with their patients over video. In this podcast, we discussed the changing landscape of telemedicine, the power of mentorship, and the importance of being brave when it comes to entrepreneurship. As always, I started the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to study medicine?
Multiple reasons. I don't think there's a single reason. From a kind of family background, we're not a family background of doctors. The only doctor we had was my uncle, who's an orthopedic surgeon from Baghdad, from Iraq. And he was somebody, as a collective family and cousins, we used to always look up to. And I think that kind of blends into the kind of cultural background, Middle Eastern background. You're either a doctor or an engineer. So that was really stressed to us. So that resulted in my big sister being a doctor. I'm a doctor. My middle sister is a dentist, and the youngest one is a doctor as well. So there was a real drive. I think on a personal level, I've always enjoyed science and talking to people, which I think is the classic answer you're going to get off most people. But I would say medicine is such a huge, broad, not just a vocation, but just a way of life that I really think there is something in it for everyone. But the difficulty is going through those hard yards of medical school, which is hard, and then going through those foundation years, which is really challenging. And I think some people get disillusioned along the way and think this is not for me and there's no place for me. And I think that's really sad because I think there really genuinely is a place for everybody in medicine. It's just getting through those hard yards to start off with.
So it's clear you had that sort of drive and that passion for medicine. But one thing you've been sort of quite involved with across your time at medical school, and probably even before, is sort of entrepreneurship. So I'm quite interested to sort of understand your entrepreneurship journey and where it really started.
I think always, to be honest with you, I've always had a job from the age of 13, 14. I used to sell mobile phones at a dog track. I used to work in the garage helping to repair vehicles. I then obviously went to medical school and I started working as a waiter. I worked at Cafe Rouge, if that's still around. I haven't seen one in ages. I worked as a waiter at Chelsea Football Club at Stamford Bridge. And then I came across realizing that it's nice to obviously work and make money, but it's nicer to work for yourself. And I think the first entrepreneur venture I went into was something called Theory Test Online. And I mean, maybe this sounds silly now, but when I was a medical student, the only way to really pass your theory test, driving theory test, was to get that thick book, sit down and read it, and then go sit the exam. And there was no online version of it at the time. So me and my family members who have continued with me on this kind of entrepreneurial journey, or I should say I've continued on their entrepreneurial journey, we made this website, Theory Test Online, where you could practice the theory test questions online and you could read the material online. And it was quite unique at its time. It was hard to juggle whilst doing medical school, and it kind of just frittered away in the end. We didn't lose any money. We made a little bit of money from it. But it really ignited my passion that, oh, if there's a problem and I can solve it, it's exciting to be your own boss. And it's quite lucrative if you can get it right.
So Abdullah, you know, you come a long way from Theory Test Online now to be running MyClinic, you know, this telemedicine supplier. I'm just wondering whether you could sort of talk through the origin story of MyClinic and talk a bit more about, you know, what exactly telemedicine is to those listening.
Yeah, so MyClinic is something which was born out of necessity. So if I take your listeners back 4 years ago, I was, you know, I'd already trained as a core surgical trainee in London. I'd worked as an accident and emergency registrar at St. Mary's Hospital and the Royal London, which some of your listeners will know are large, busy trauma hospitals. I then went up to Leeds to actually start GP training because I thought, okay, I want to mix my work. I don't want to just fully be a doctor. I want to be a doctor and continue entrepreneurial stuff. So I founded a company called Medical Chain, and Medical Chain originally is designed to empower patients to have access to the medical records, to remove healthcare barriers, and to improve patient choice. And that's a journey we're still going on at the moment, and thankfully we're doing quite well there. whilst on that journey, we realized that really the future of communicating with patients is going to be remote, it's going to be video calling. So we were building a module part of medical chain to serve that purpose. And as we were building it, we then had the COVID-19 pandemic. And we realized that, you know, maybe in the UK or in the US, we're very blessed that there's so many different options available to us. In countries such as Nigeria, any in South America, for example, you know, we were hearing from friends and family, I cannot see a doctor, the doctor's self-isolating, or I have to self-isolate, and there's just no access to healthcare. So we took that module we were making for medical chain, and we just made it a standalone solution and called it MyClinic, the telemedicine solution. And essentially, it was a virtual waiting room. It's free to use. It's still free to use. And it's been used in over 78 countries to date. And we're going from strength to strength. We're used in the NHS, in private healthcare, beyond doctors, you know, dentists, social workers, dietitians, you know, you name it. There's lots of people using it in a clinical setting. So that's something we're quite proud of, that we managed to step up, you know, improvise, innovate, and give something to really help people with a challenging situation we've all gone through.
I really like how you sort of adapted your approach, you know, based on the sort of feedback you got from those end users. You know, is that what entrepreneurship's all about? It's about adapting to, you know, your data and feedback, and, you know, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. So thankfully, like anybody, I would say, you know, to your listeners, we've all got mentors. So never look at anybody and think, wow, they're a genius. You know, they did it all by themselves, or they're so hardworking, they did it all by themselves. That's rare, or I'd even argue that's a load of crap. Everybody's got somebody that they look up to. Everybody's got somebody that bounce ideas off. And one of the best pieces of advice that I've had from my mentors is start off with what you think is right. So you found a problem and you're starting off with something you're passionate about, what you think is right. But the moment you start getting feedback from real users, that needs to be your driving source. That needs to be the fuel in your car driving you forwards. Because there's no point in just pushing off in a direction where you keep thinking, I know I'm right. I'm not going to pivot. I'm not going to relook at this. I'm not going to, you know, I was right a year ago. I was right 2 years ago. I was right 4 years ago. Nothing's changed and I'm right, even though I've got no users and no feedback and I'm going nowhere. When you start having users and you start having feedback, that's where you start pivoting, because you start leaning into that market and thinking, okay, maybe this is what people actually want, and maybe this is something which is similar to what I want. And if I can deliver this first and get it right, I can go back to my original idea of what I was trying to do. And I think for your listeners who are, you know, PhD students or people involved in research, it's the equivalent of, you will write your PhD idea down and say, this is what I'm trying to discover. This is what I'm trying to add to the subject material, which is like a grain of sand on top of a whole pile of sand. But then you realize your grain of sand can't sit on anything because the thing you actually need to discuss hasn't been invented yet. So you go down a level. Okay, but that's not even had proper research or validation yet. So you go down another level and you realize that you're actually three or four phases away from your original PhD idea. And now that's your PhD because the other things before it don't exist. And I say that's exactly the same in business. You'll have a brilliant idea. Why has no one thought of this? This would make the world so much better. Okay, that's great. But the reason no one's done it yet is because three or four steps are missing before that. And that's what you actually start working on.
So when you went about sort of building that initial MVP, how did you go about sort of building it? Because surely it's quite a complex problem. You're bringing quite a, I suppose, a simple solution towards it. So when you went about sort of addressing this issue, this problem, you know, how did you go about building that initial MVP? Because, you know, it seems like a very complex problem, trying to address, you know, the communication aspect to deliver these healthcare services. So how do you sort of approach it, I suppose?
Yeah, so it is complex and simple in the same context. So it's complex because of the actual man hours that need to go into building it, testing it, and making sure that it doesn't fail. But it's simple in the concept, in the sense that what are we trying to build? A telemedicine platform. Do those exist? Yes. Okay, but why would somebody use ours? What's our unique selling point or USP you'll hear people refer to? Well, it's because ours is custom made, it's built in-house. We're not relying on any kind of third-party software like other kind of telemedicine providers. Ours has a virtual waiting room. Ours alleviates any kind of admin burden that a clinician might need to do, and somebody else can arrange those appointments for them. So slowly, slowly, you start taking a very simple idea and making it up and making it a bit more complex. The danger of doing that, and you know, a warning I would say to people, is you don't want to be so feature rich but user poor. So you can keep innovating and creating feature after feature after feature. It's like, yeah, but nobody's using it yet. you know, and you're just going off in a tunnel, spending money, spending time, and you haven't even got the basics right yet. And the real challenge you have to ask your users when you do have a user base is, would you pay for this?
So of course you've got sort of, you know, two sides of your brain. You've got that sort of entrepreneurship part and you've got the clinical part, which you sort of combine together. But how do you sort of go about balancing those two things? You know, how do you know whether it's sort of worth dipping your toe into the entrepreneurship world, you know, as a medical student or even as a doctor?
Yeah, it's a challenging one. I think it's a really personal one, you know, on depending on your personal circumstances, depending on your age. So for example, I'm 34, I'm married, my parents are in good health. I don't have other burdens or other things pulling me in different directions. So I'm okay to juggle my time. And I realized that, as I said, you know, having trained as a surgeon or as an A&E doctor, I realized I couldn't juggle those things with an entrepreneurial life. It's just not possible. And I'd even argue, you know, in some cases, it's not right. You know, if I have a surgical problem and somebody needs to operate on me, I want the surgeon who is committed to surgery, who's, you know, lived and breathed surgery from day one, and they've done this procedure 1,000 times. I don't want the clinical entrepreneur who dabbles in a bit of surgery and hasn't really done this procedure in about 6 months because they've been on an elective with Google or something, and now they're going to come do my appendix. So it's a very, very hard balance. And I think, you know, that opinion that I say there might be unpopular, but it's true. And I think you'll find that in a lot of walks of life, when people tell you, you can have it all. No, it's a load of crap. You know, there's 24 hours in a day. You cannot have it all. Something, somewhere, the quality is going to not be at its very best because you're having to compensate with something else. Unless you get tons of help and everybody else doing your job for you, you're not going to be able to have both those careers. So I think pick a medical career which lends itself to independence and you being the boss of your own time, and that will give you the flexibility that you need. More and above, you know, the idea of the prestige or the money or whatever else comes with it.
So, you know, clearly COVID-19 has accelerated this adoption of telemedicine services, you know, across the NHS and abroad, of course. But what do you think have been some of the barriers to this adoption? You know, why has it taken so long for levels to increase, you know, telephone and video consultations to sort of increase over time?
Yeah, I mean, sadly speaking, you know, and I can only really speak from a kind of UK perspective, because we're doing quite well in the US, and I can see that in the UK it's better, and some of the people in NHS Digital, NHSX, will be patting themselves on the back saying a job well done, whereas I'd argue, no, you guys have done crap. You know, telemedicine, as well as lots of other kind of tech solutions, have been around for ages. You know, we've been using MSN chat, we've been using Skype, you know, all of these things existed, and doctors have been crying out for it, and patients have been saying, is there not a more efficient way than driving an hour, parking in a car park, paying £10, running late to the clinic, sitting in a waiting room for half an hour to see a doctor for 5 minutes to say, yeah, your blood tests were fine, thanks for coming. You know, but the bureaucracy that we have, that is the real, you know, challenge. That is the brick wall where people will tell you, no, it can't be done. And it's not because it can't be done. It's the effort required to make it happen is not, for them, worth their time. And they'd rather keep the status quo than actually challenge, try, and you know what? You might actually fail. And that's not a problem. Failing is a good thing. Fail fast, learn fast, and then go at it again and think, why did this not work? You know, this is a chronic problem we have up and down the country, where anytime somebody tries to innovate, you will have somebody which will tell you why it won't work. And that's really unhelpful. What you want is somebody saying, I can see where you're going to get stuck, but I'm going to help you get through those challenges. You know, one of the things we have in the hospital systems for people that are clinically active, you'll say, why are we still running on the old version of Windows? Why have we not updated this? And simply put, it's because 300 applications need to work on that old system of Windows. None of those applications have been updated. So if the hospital actually update to the current modern software and current computing power, they're going to have to fix all those 300 applications to work on the modern software. So they just don't do it. They don't do any system updates. So this is the problem we're getting stuck in. It's the effort, the courage, which is needed to say, look, enough is enough. We need to make this happen. And I think the pandemic was brilliant for that, because information governance and all this other kind of nonsense that goes around it, oh, we don't have studies to show how effective telemedicine has been. All right, man, chill out. Like, we've got a pandemic. Like, let's just help people and then we'll figure it out. No, but data is going to get lost and everyone's information is going to be on YouTube. where? You know, we've been doing telemedicine now with COVID for a year and a half, 2 years. Where are all these doomsday scenarios that they were talking about? So I really think, you know, as a generation, you know, especially your generation, you really need to push on and not accept that stuff. And anybody tells you, well, that's the way we've always done it, you know something is wrong there and you need to go out and push even harder there.
So I'm guessing one of the barriers has been that sort of, you know, mental aspect of things and that sort of resistance to adopting these services. So how do you go about addressing that sort of issue, that sort of clinician resistance, I suppose? So I'm guessing one of the barriers has been sort of clinician resistance, you know, to these sort of things. How would you go about addressing this resistance to change in some scenarios?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll find that, you know, the clinicians at the moment, you know, are changing, you know, so the kind of old style thinking is really going out of the window, and they are retiring, you know, time has moved on and you do have new clinicians coming forward, you know, the kind of iPhone generation clinicians who are very accepting and do want to try. And you know what? They are going to find problems with your solution. They are going to tell you, this is crap. I don't think this works very well. It's not intuitive. And that's because they're used to very good applications and very good web pages and websites. And that's great because these people know what it should look like, what it should feel like. And that's the kind of feedback I was talking about in the beginning. These are the people that you need to impress because they know what they're talking about. The issue, which I think is no longer going to be true in the near future, is that the people you're trying to impress is the people that don't even know how to use their phone properly. You know, and this kind of clinician adoption, I think, is going to be less and less of a challenge because clinicians want to do things faster and easier. You know, they've realized that they can book a taxi with Uber. So why was I doing it any other way? They realized they could go on Skyscanner and get their flights. So why the hell was I going around travel agents on the high street trying to sort my flights out? And these are the same kind of medics and professionals that are going to say, you know, why could I not just have received that patient's photo as an upload? Why could I not have just sent them a link to a website telling them these are the exercises I need you to do for your, you know, hip arthritis or whatever it may be? So I think the clinician adoption is not the problem. I think the patient adoption, you know, is really not a problem. I have patients refusing to see me in clinic now. You know, I will offer them a face-to-face appointment and they'll say, can I not just send you a photo? And that's because they've wisened up as well. They've got, you know, broadly speaking, if it's a life or death situation, it needs to be dealt with now. If it's some kind of 2-week referral, some kind of cancer issue, it needs to be dealt with now. Look, for anything else, okay, you've got a bit of a rash there, try this cream. Okay, I've come back after a week, the cream's not worked. Okay, do you want to try this cream? Yeah, this one's not worked. Okay, fine, look, we've done this twice remotely, it's not worked. I think you really should come in for a face-to-face because either I'm getting the diagnosis wrong or we're getting the treatment wrong. And patients have realized, you know, that not everything has to be dealt with there and then on the day. And I think that's credit to the clinicians and the management of practices and hospitals, which are now pushing back against patient demand and saying, look, it's a pandemic. You need to give us a bit of a break. If it's something serious, we'll deal with it now. If it's not, let's try and just manage it remotely.
So of course, I had a look at your MyClinic booklet, which you can find on the website, but I also put a sort of link in the description below, which talks through how to go about sort of implementing a telemedicine service for your practice. And, you know, one thing it sort of picked up upon was the importance of gatekeepers, which you sort of refer to, you know, as a sort of receptionist working in a practice. So how do we sort of go about, you know, convincing and demonstrating to these receptionists the importance of adopting these services to make it easy for them to sort of increase the levels we've already been seeing?
I think the gatekeepers are quite flexible, but they need leadership. You know, that, you know, for all the kind of reception admin people I work with on a day-to-day basis in the different clinics that I work in as a locum GP, you know, they're fantastic and they're really motivated. And the common theme I see from reception staff admin is burnout. You know, they are tired and they want solutions like this. There's a very good solution called Ask My GP, which is a great way for patients to get in touch with the general practice site, the clinic, and say, could I have this repeat prescription? Could I do this? Could I do that? The admin reception team loved it because it streamlined things. It took all the burden off the telephones. But the clinicians did not adapt their way of working and they started drowning in it. And they said, no, we're not doing this anymore. And they went back to the old system of the telephones. So the admin reception team got smashed again. And the clinicians were like, well, this is just better for us. And I think that's the real challenge, is nobody denies that the technology does exactly what it's meant to do. And I'd really like somebody to challenge, you know, that concept. Most clinical products, when they say this is what we do, they deliver. It does what it says on the tin. The reason the software doesn't work out is because the adaptations or the changes or the flow of patients that needs to occur in the practice does not occur. And that's where the whole thing falls apart. You know, for this to work, we need you to do this. No, I'd rather not do that. Yeah, but what you're doing is not going to work. It's futile because you are literally losing clinicians to burnout. You're losing admin. You've got a high turnover of staff. You really need to relook at your business model and your strategy here. So I think, you know, the gatekeepers themselves, they're crying out for change as well. There's always a competing balance of giving patients the best and easiest access to a clinician or to a clinical setting, but that does not necessarily remove any burden or stress off the clinical team. You know, patients can call, email, text, app. Okay, fine. And the practice is now drowning in all this information. There's now so many different ways the patient can get in touch. So you've made things better for the patient, but have you actually solved the clinician's problem of how they're going to deal with that workload? So these are the kind of things you need to factor in. And that I'd say that most of the solutions you find today, they're actually really beneficial for the admin teams and the reception teams because they don't solve the clinician's problem of dealing with the volume of workload. They're left behind, unfortunately.
So sort of looking forward now, you know, where do you see the role of MyClinic over the next, you know, 5-10 years or so?
For me, it's now trying to go on a kind of digital marketing push, is to make people more aware of this product and the differences and why they should try it. It should be going out really hard, trying to seek patient and doctor feedback. And I say the word doctor, I mean, any clinician can use this system, of course. And, you know, thankfully, we've already had some offers for people to buy us out. We've already had some offers for people to invest in us. And I think it's too premature to do that. I think there's a lot more work we can do internally and push this thing out before we're ready to call it a day and hand it over to somebody else.
So absolutely, you know, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. But before you go, I was just wondering whether you had, you know, three sort of tips that you could give to students who are interested in possibly exploring, you know, clinical entrepreneurship opportunities in the future.
I'd say number one, be brave and challenge the status quo. So, you know, if you know something doesn't seem right and you want to fix it, then be brave. You know, don't be put off by titles and seniority. By all means, don't get me wrong. You know, if somebody's your senior or somebody is the consultant or the professor, you need to respect them and you need to show them that respect, but it doesn't mean you need to agree with them. So you need to be brave, I say, is the first thing I say. The second thing I'd say is collaborate. So again, nobody is a hero by themselves. Trust me on this one. You know, people have these very, unfortunately, small-minded ideas. Sometimes they receive bad advice that tells them, look, why are you going to share this company with somebody else? You know, why are you going to give up this equity of a company that could be worth 200 million? Again, you're not Elon Musk. Chill your boots. You're giving up 20% or something worth zero. So work with somebody and then maybe you'll get something together with somebody rather than trying to have 100% of nothing. So be brave, collaborate. And I think the last thing to do is say network. And I think that's something you do really well. And that's something that your peers as well and the other people that have reached out to me and to other kind of people that we're only a few steps ahead of you. Like, I mean, on paper, obviously, like we look like a big deal. I mean, my company, we raised $24 million. We had an office in London, office in Switzerland. It all sounds very impressive on paper, but I promise you, it's only a few years ahead of you. And there's the people ahead of us, like Jean, who was part of Touch Surgery. You know, they went and sold their company for 9 figures. And Jean is, you know, only a few years ahead of us as well. So always look ahead of you and network with those people. And I think you'll find that they are quite receptive because they empathize with you. They remember when they were in your position. So always try to reach out. And I'm sure you'll find people that want to help you.
Abdullah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
That's a pleasure. Thank you again for inviting me.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you all enjoyed it. If you did, I'd really appreciate if you give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter with all the links in the description below. Until next time, thank you so much for listening and take care.